I'm David Martin Davies, and coming up on The Source, for over a year, the Trump administration has been executing a mass deportation agenda. The Immigration and Customs Enforcement Dragnet has scooped up mainly non-criminal immigrants. The impact has been disruptive, spreading fear and cruelty. The consequences are being felt across the broader economy. Employers in construction, agriculture, hospitality, and food service are struggling with labor shortages and uncertainty. There is an emotional and financial toll on families being torn apart. All of this is making us less free. Coming up, a recent live panel discussion that I moderated, organized by the National Council of Jewish Women San Antonio. Paths, barriers, and possibilities, immigration in America. That's what's coming up on The Source, but first, this news.
Support for The Source podcast comes from UT Health San Antonio, South Texas' largest academic research institution, where what is discovered in its labs translates into life-changing patient care. More at uthealthsa.org.
From the John L. Santico Studio in downtown San Antonio, this is The Source from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. I recently moderated a live panel discussion titled Paths, Barriers, and Possibilities, Immigration in America. The event was organized by the National Council of Jewish Women San Antonio and was hosted at Trinity University's Ruth Taylor Recital Hall. On the panel were San Antonio Congressman Joaquin Castro, San Antonio State Representative Diego Bernal, and immigration attorney Kate Lincoln Goldfinch. The panel organizers had reached out and invited local Republican elected officials, but none agreed to join the conversation. Is this a hard issue to really understand, to see how it's really impacting people on a day-to-day level? The cruelty, so the cruelty is the point. The incompetency is also the point. There's a lot happening in this sphere that we really have got to understand in order to engage in the democratic process to fight for better public policy. Each of y'all occupy a different lane in talking about this issue. We can hear from Congressman Castro about where it looks like from his view, nationally speaking. Also, Kate talked about her incredible immigration firm that she has. I really want to hear from Representative Castro about what you learned in Dilley with the Liam case. But first, let's talk about what's happening. And we know we have the partial government shutdown. We have a lot of activation. What are you seeing right now?
Well, I think, well, first of all, David, it's great to be with you. Thank you for moderating. And also, you know, of course, to my fellow panelists and to the San Antonio chapter of National Council of Jewish Women. Thank you all so much for convening us and for convening this conversation right now. Just quick context, as you all know, throughout American history, there have been times where our country has become quite anti-immigrant and nativist, and we are living through one of those periods right now. And so, you know, when we talk about the situation with the Department of Homeland Security, I know there's been a lot of debate about the shutdown. We finally, I thought, had an agreement in the Senate that the House would pass to fund everything at the department except for ICE and CBP enforcement because of the way that it's been done and the violation of people's rights. Unfortunately, Speaker Johnson and the Republican majority in the House didn't go for that, and so sent back over what's called a continuing resolution, full funding for ICE and everything else in DHS, so that ping pong battle continues. But remember, through what was called a big, beautiful bill last year, ICE got an extra $75 billion on top of its annual allocation. So it's not about, it's not a question of whether ICE has the money that it needs to function. It certainly does. It's whether the Trump administration is willing to use that money from the big, beautiful bill to cover these daily operations. And then, you know, just very quickly, I think what's been going on is very, very dehumanizing. There's a brutality that we've seen on the streets of the Twin Cities, but also in Chicago and Los Angeles and other places. But there's also a brutality that most people don't see behind the closed walls of what are essentially prisons. Dilley is a trailer prison. And it's the only place in America that I can think of where we imprison children who have not committed any crime. The youngest child, when I first went there, was 2 months old. Liam Ramos was 5 years old when he was there. And so, you know, for me, when I think about what we stand for as a country, I think we're better than that. And I can't wait for a course correction in the November election and then in 2028 and what's to come.
Kate, how are you seeing things? I mean, you have a very active practice at your own law firm, and you were dealing a lot with expedited removals. How is this tearing families apart?
I want to echo the congressman's gratitude for this event. These events are really important, and it's an honor for me to be here up on this panel. I've been an immigration lawyer in Texas for 20 years, and I became an immigration advocate in law school. I signed up for the immigration clinic. It was during the Bush presidency. And the first detention center for families had been opened. And I was sent to do an intake with a family that was detained there. It was a mom, a dad, and a little five-month-old baby girl. And they were all wearing prison uniforms. Her little onesie was a little prison onesie. And her mom asked me if I would take her baby and take care of her until they could get out of that detention center. And that night I went home and I just sobbed. I had been so naive about what this country stood for until I saw it with my own eyes. And ever since then, I've been working with families who are facing the consequences of brutal immigration policies throughout varying administrations, but nothing. And what I've seen is like what is happening today, this mass scale of detention of people and families is so brutal and violent. And one major difference is that historically in the last 20 years, when there has been family detention, most of the people detained are detained temporarily, and they are people who came to the border seeking asylum. And it's never been okay. But that's the difference. And essentially in the first day of the second administration, Trump hit the reset button to the end of the first administration and essentially closed the border and then turned their sights to the interior enforcement. And that's when we've seen families who are living and existing and doing everything the right way for decades, many of them, get swept up and taken and disappeared from their families. And we're seeing big actions like what happens in Minnesota and Chicago, and that's brutal and violent, and it stirs a public outrage. But one thing that I think is really important, and this is why I think these forums are so important, is that what's happening in Texas is as massive in scale as what we saw in Minnesota, more so, but it's invisible and it's insidious, and it's because of state policies in Texas. It's because Greg Abbott deputized DPS to become immigration enforcers. And really probably every single one of us in this room has driven by someone being disappeared and taken from their families on the streets without even realizing it, because DPS troopers and some other law enforcement agents in Texas pull people over on pretextual traffic stops and take them. And we don't see it. And so we don't have the same massive outrage and upswell in Texas, but more people are being disappeared, and many of them are pressured into signing a deportation immediately and they're gone. And also many of them are held in detention indefinitely in these horrific conditions. And as lawyers, we're having to take most of these fights on an individual case-by-case basis into federal court to get habeas, because immigration court is a mess and they won't grant bond. And so people are detained, when they're lucky, for 3 or 4 months and paying thousands and thousands of dollars. And I'm talking 20 years in this country, no criminal history, U.S. citizen kids, good, decent, hardworking people plucked off the road because their license plate was askew. And these kids, see these cases up close. I know many of us have. I mean, and you can just imagine the trauma of something like that. And some of these kids watch their parents get taken. And it's horrific and heartbreaking and cruel, and I believe that cruelty is the point. And so we have to stay aware and informed and absolutely outraged, which I know we all are, and that's why we're here.
We're taking a quick break, and we'll be right back with more of the panel, Paths, Barriers, and Possibilities, Immigration in America. Stay with us.
Support for this podcast of The Source comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' compensation provider committed to rewarding policyholders who keep their workers safe and losses low. More at texasmutual.com/TXM Advantage. Texas Mutual. Texans get it.
You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies, and we're bringing to air a live panel discussion, Paths, Barriers, and Possibilities, Immigration in America. Representative Bernal talks about what's happening from the view from the state capitol, sure. Texas National Guard, what's happening in Dilley. And you should be able to go to Dilley. They're using Texas dollars to fund that place, but you're not allowed to.
We should. So Texas is the petri dish for this. We're the laboratory. Everything that you're seeing nationwide has been tried and tested in Texas already. And that's why I believe Texas was so prepared to take part, right? To add to that cruelty, the infrastructure was already set up to execute this plan that we believe was conceived in DC, but really it wasn't. We were trying to do this in Texas for over a decade, and we were able to resist and resist and get little pieces, and finally the wave just came, and here we are. I agree 100% that cruelty is the point. I think it is important to say that the genesis and the impetus, in large part, is racist. They're going to immigration courts in my district, in our district, for people who are going and doing it the right way and taking them. I'm glad you used the word disappear, because that's exactly what it is. And if this had been 60 years ago, they would have taken my dad, who never became a citizen. He was an LPR. He had these court dates. You know, decent guy, good kids, right? So, and I've got other people in my family who are immigrants through marriage, who are not Mexican or Latin American. They're European. They're fine. I'm not saying it doesn't happen. I'm saying it doesn't happen nearly as much, right? The stops that you're talking about, the people they're targeting, who they're looking at in the courthouses, it's very clear, it's very obvious. So I think, yes, it is wrong. Yes, it is illegal. Yes, cruelty is the point, but it also sends a message, and it is focused on a certain group of people, right, that are undesirable and have also the problems of the state and the country have been laid at the feet, and the finger's been pointed at them and saying, this is why all the things wrong in your life are because of them. And there's no group that should understand how harmful it is more than the people in this room. And so I think it's important that we can have a policy discussion, but if we're being super honest, it is one of the most racist things that we've seen in our lifetimes. And we're not even looking back on it. We're literally in the middle of it. And that's why it requires the kind of attention that we're trying to give it today. Because as we saw in Minnesota, that is the only way that things change. And no offense to any one of the three of us, but we're sort of like the punctuation marks at the end of sentences written by the public, right?
Okay. So, Joaquin, can you talk about how you came to the Liam Ramos story, and how is he doing right now?
Doing okay. You know, they lost the first round of their asylum case, so they're appealing now, and that appeal, as Kate knows, can go for months or, you know, historically even years to finally get a final resolution on it. You know, I had, in the first Trump term, I was chair of the Congressional Hispanic Caucus for two of those years and had arranged the first rally against family separation on June 1st, I believe, of 2018 on the west side of San Antonio. And So when Donald Trump got elected again in November of 2024, we knew what was coming, and we suspected that it would be worse, and it has been worse. And so right away last year, my staff and I started jumping into and started getting a lot of outreach from people who were ending up. There are multiple Texas facilities. In addition to Dilley, there are immigration detention centers in Pearsall, in Carnes, in Port Isabel, in the Rio Grande Valley. So there's a lot of this immigration detention and shelter infrastructure in Texas. We jumped into it again. And when the case of Liam Ramos happened, there was this period where members of Congress, we had been able to just show up at these detention centers and go inspect them. But the Trump administration started forcing us, and then this was litigated, but forcing us to give 7 days notice. So while this was being litigated in court, that was still the rule. And I saw the story break about, you know, we saw Liam with his backpack, the Spider-Man backpack, and his blue cap, and it was just an incredibly cute picture of a young boy that could have been in San Antonio or anywhere in America. And I had put in a request the day before to go a week later to Dilley. So I heard that he was going to be sent to Dilley, and I thought, well, I can do something about this because I'm scheduled to go there in 6 days. And that's how we jumped into the middle of it. I was actually with James Tallarico at a rally in Austin on all these issues on ICE. And we got a call from his lawyer saying, because they filed a writ of habeas corpus that was successful. Judge Beery, if anybody knows Judge Beery. And Judge Beery went to Jefferson High School just like Diego and I did, if there are any Mustangs here. So Judge Beery, you know, signed off on the writ, and the lawyers called me on Saturday and said, can you all help us and pick him up? And I was in Austin, so we drove down from Austin over to Dilley, and then that's the video that you probably saw of when we're, you know, helping them carry their stuff out. It's like a prison. When you go in there, they take all your stuff, they put it in a bag, they check it in, and when you come out, they give you your stuff back. And he was, you know, they were elated, and the first thing that he wanted was a Happy Meal, and so we took him to McDonald's to get a Happy Meal. And I say it's a trailer prison because it's a series of trailers when you walk in there, and it's 12 people per room, so multiple families per room. The families are actually still separated because the men are not allowed to stay with the women and children. They're in another area, so they are still separated. In the evening. And so when we heard about the measles outbreak, for example, or at least two people had measles, the first thing I thought about was 12 people in a room in very close quarters and what that would mean for any kind of outbreak. Those are no conditions. Really, remember, nobody at Dilley, ICE is the one that told me this the first time I went, no one at Dilley has committed a crime. So we talked about the kids, but even the adults. Many of these folks were people that were showing up for their asylum hearings. And they got, you know, they showed up for a hearing, and instead of going in front of the, you know, or being able to go home afterwards, they were basically handcuffed and taken in and sent to rural Texas. And so nobody's committed a crime, and yet they're being treated like criminals. And then also, David, you know, the last thing on this, two things actually. With respect to the kids there especially, we're all attorneys actually, those kids don't have any legal rights really when they go in front of that judge. They don't have a right to counsel, so they'll sit there, young kids will sit there not understanding what the legal proceedings are that will determine whether they get to stay in the United States or they're deported. I mean, if you think about it, in terms of legal counsel, they literally have less rights than a convicted serial killer. I mean, really. A convicted serial killer would have a public defender. These kids have no one. The other part of the system that's very ironic, really quick, is that we've commodified, in this case with Dilley, child imprisonment, child suffering. The reason I say that is because some of the nation's largest asset managers own stakes in CoreCivic that owns Dilley and operates Dilley. Remember, it's ICE, on the public side and the Texas National Guard on the public side, but then it's also a private company, CoreCivic, that operates Dilley. And so they're the ones that organize education, the meals, the education. There was no education there for 11 months, no schooling at all for any of the kids. And we have essentially commodified that in the United States to allow for people to invest in it, which I think in its own way is grotesque.
Kate, if you could talk about, because you're tuned in also to the very rural aspect of what is happening, because your law firm has been pioneering about how to bring these services to people who are not in the big cities. You have your yellow school bus, but I'm really interested in how these mass deportations are hurting counties, agricultural centers, places where this labor is vitally important for us as a nation, as an economy, and what are you seeing there?
So we don't have to divide between rural and urban when we talk about impact on economy, because it is across the board. The truth is, every sector of our economy has been impacted by immigration enforcement, at least indirectly. They added the $100,000 fee to the H-1B visas, then they targeted all the student visa holders. So people who are highly educated, highly skilled, are less likely to come and work in the United States. And of course, that impacts STEM fields and entrepreneurship. And then there are more traditional immigrant sectors, hospitality, agriculture, construction, landscaping, and those sectors are all down by 30% in Dallas. 40% of construction workers are immigrants in Texas. And so every sector is really suffering. And in the agricultural sector, there have been raids on farms which have resulted in actual workers being detained and deported. But fear of raids has driven down labor in the agricultural sector. And so the response to that by the Trump administration was to expand agricultural worker visas. But what they did when they expanded those options is they drove down the wages by 30%. And they did things like saying, oh, now when you provide housing for seasonal agricultural workers, you can count that as part of the wage. When people who jump around to farms in different, they go pick, strawberries in Colorado, they stay in trailers on the farms. Housing is just part of the work. And now the Trump administration has said, well, we can count that as part of the wage. And so it's driving down wages for farm workers. And so all across every sector, but particularly agricultural sectors, where our economy is definitely suffering. And this is, of course, at a time when our baby boomers are aging and we need more workers, and our birth rates are down. We need people who will care for the elderly. One in two home healthcare workers in the state of Texas is an immigrant. And so we're really cutting off our nose to spite our face. And I know we all know that, but this nation desperately needs immigrant labor, not only because it creates the vibrancy of our nation, but actually just our economy in order to survive needs immigrant labor. And that's why the rhetoric of conservatives and MAGA and the Trump administration and this anti-immigrant sentiment that we're in is so dangerous, because when these politicians campaign, using those words that we see Greg Abbott use about immigrants, then they're hypocritical if they get into office and they do anything pro-immigrant. And so it's really dangerous, this rhetoric. And I think that, frankly, one of the ways that our team has failed is in balancing out the rhetoric and the conversation. I think we're doing better now because it's so acute, but I think that during the Biden administration, there was a lot of time when, if we weren't talking about immigration, that was kind of a good day. And we allowed the definition and the rhetoric and the language around immigration to just get out there into the ether. That's rapists, murderers, eating the pets, all that stuff. And we weren't loud enough over here about, hey, that's not true. I mean, statistics, data, the economy, but also just, We've come so far, we don't even really talk about celebrating immigrants anymore. You know, I mean, just restaurants and culture and music and art and just all of the ways that immigration makes this country fun and bright. And so I don't know exactly where I was going to go with that, but you know, I mean, that's what it's like. Can we get back to that? That's what the bus is all about. Like, we put cumbia music on, have bubble machines, and we're handing out Know Your Rights cards and free legal resources, but we're like, let's make this a party. This is should be fun, you know, when we get a bunch of immigrants together.
We got to hit pause on the panel discussion, paths, barriers, and possibilities, immigration in America, to get a break in. Stand by, and we'll be right back. This is The Source from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. We're broadcasting a recent live panel discussion, Paths, Barriers, and Possibilities, Immigration in America, organized by the National Council of Jewish Women San Antonio. With me on the panel were San Antonio Congressman Joaquin Castro, San Antonio State Representative Diego Bernal, and Immigration Attorney Kate Lincoln Goldfinch.
So Texas leadership, these are practical problems. Dealing with housing costs, dealing with the rising cost of food, trying to deal with getting oil out of the ground, all of these things require immigrant labor. How are they going to square that circle when that labor is gone? Don't they have to answer for the problem that they created?
I love the way you asked the question. No, they don't have the answer. I think part of it is, you know, my mom has this great phrase, which is, you have to be ready to get what you ask for, right? And I think that's what's happened in Texas, is that they pushed so hard. I know you were trying to get me to this point, and Joaquin touched on it, but I want to make it clear. When we think of immigration, we think of the federal government. We think of Dilley, we think it's a federal facility, and it is. And what that means to most of us is that local electeds, local government, state government can't touch it. But to drive the point home, Texas is actively participating in the operations of Dilley because of, on Greg Abbott's order, the Texas National Guard is there. And not just there, but they're helping run it, they're helping house it, they're helping keeping families and children detained in these sort of subhuman conditions. Do not let the state of Texas off the hook. It's not just that they've tried to pass all of these bills, they're actively participating in the activity. So there's that. Greg Abbott, in particular, so badly wants an attaboy, like a belly rub from Donald Trump, that he's not really willing to do or say anything. And you're watching this play out in the primary between Paxton and Cornyn, where they're both falling over themselves trying to be the one that daddy loves best. Right? I mean, and Cornyn literally has pictures of him standing in front of Trump Burger and reading Trump's book. I really feel like they're trying to ride this out. And the reason I know that is because the legislature meets for 6 to 8 months every other year. We don't go back until January. In between sessions, you get what are called interim charges, which is a list of priorities that they want us to focus on and study and talk about and have hearings around the state. And none of this is on there. Sharia law is on there.
Taking two counties from New Mexico is...
And so was annexing parts of New Mexico. To get into the mind of politicians, the two of us excluded, is that for most of them, their seat is the most precious thing in their life. And they don't make decisions to serve people, they make decisions to keep being that thing, because they don't know who they are without being that thing. What scares them, then, is a threat to that thing. And the only real threat to that thing is people. And so information, conversation, right, demonstration, I didn't mean for that all to rhyme, but that was cool. All of that really matters. And if you want to go out and protest, protest. If you want to host something like this, do that. If all you can do is tweet or whatever it's called now, or post on Facebook, do that. But that, those things, those activities, it takes all types, all sorts. Those activities are the things that scare them into doing something different. So on paper, as they've telegraphed to us, they have no plans. But I do believe that they can be scared into changing course, or we just change the people, which is also fine, better actually.
Well, you expect me to believe that they have no plan? You know, that's like launching a war against Iran and not having a plan.
It's politics over everything, right? And I always ask my colleagues, to what end? You're doing this, you're taking this position, you're falling in line behind this person, to what end? What is the end goal here? And they often don't know. They just want to keep being that thing. You know, Joaquin and I talk, we've known each other for a super long time, probably about almost 40 years. I tell him, like, you make Congress look very unsexy. You don't make it look like someone is dying to do it. But there's something about these seats that becomes the identity of these folks. And then they don't know what to do and they panic if that identity is threatened. So that's what keeps them in line. It makes them do things without a plan. It also is a way to either change them in terms of their activity, or we just switch them out.
What difference would it make if the Democrats become the majority party, this is say in the House, in regards to dealing with immigration?
Well, first, I think Democrats are going to take back the House of Representatives. And hopefully the United States Senate as well, right? This is an interesting question because obviously I'm all for it. I want to see it. I think that we will take back the House. What would it mean? I think we would have more checks and balances against Donald Trump when it comes to things like what he's spending money on, because the Congress appropriates the money, but also for the investigations and oversight that we're able to do on what I believe is arguably the most corrupt administration in American history. So that will be very important. But I'm also concerned because I think that it could bring a period. This is a president who I believe has violated the Constitution, who has certainly pushed the limits of the Constitution, has at times ignored Congress and ignored the law. And the risk you run there is that a constitutional crisis could come when the Congress declares something, passes a law, you know, and the president ignores it. In the back of my mind, that's where I think you could have real issues. Right now, we haven't seen any of that because Mike Johnson and John Thune, the House and the Senate, under Republican control, have been completely subsumed by Donald Trump and the White House. They haven't offered any resistance. The legislative identity, Congress's identity, has really just merged with the White House. But what happens when that's no longer the case and you actually have a Congress that's going in a different direction? What is this president, who has acted illegally at times, what is that president going to do? Is he finally going to follow what Congress is doing, as he should by law, or is he going to violate the law and ignore Congress? So that's what, I guess, keeps me up at night right now, looking ahead.
I mean, could there be real investigations, real hearings, get some answers about why Homeland Security, how they do things?
Yes, these investigations should happen. I think when it comes to ICE and the way ICE has conducted enforcement, what has also happened in the detention centers or prisons, I think that the Congress ought to form a special commission to investigate the abuses that have happened over the past, what at that time will be 2 years.
Kate, what can you tell me about the lives of people who have been deported through this rapid deportation? Where do they go? How do they end up? What's their life like?
Well, it's different for everyone. And the truth is, I don't have a lot of contact with my clients once they go. You know, sometimes they check back in with me and let me know how they're doing. There are some that particularly stick with me and I follow up with them. One of them was one of the first arrests at a courthouse. Her name is Carmen. And she went to legal hearing. 6 U.S. citizen daughters, U.S. citizen husband. The littlest of the girls was 7. And she was taken at the courthouse, and ultimately, after a couple of months in detention, she said, I can't take it anymore, I gotta get out of here. But during that 2-month period, I would visit their house, and the girls, they were all super into like hair and makeup and stuff they would do with their mom. She was real girly, and they all did that together. And watching them try to cling to that without their mom there was really sad to see. I mean, the girls were not getting along very well. The fridge was full of, you know, old vegetables. And it was just the absence of mom was so heavy in that house. And they all ended up going back to Mexico. But the two oldest girls were thriving in high school, and they didn't want to go. And they were worried about going and what it would mean for their future. And I tried checking in with that family, and I get a, we're fine, you know, it's okay. But I guess what I can say is I have yet to connect with a client post-deportation who's celebrating and happy about it. You know, I'm thinking of another client from El Salvador. He was a police officer, single dad, came with his son and was one of the early deportees in the second administration. He was really worried about going back because once they come here and they have an asylum case and they've gone on record and they say stuff, it's even more risky for them to go back. The last update I got from him was that it was just really hard for them to acclimate back to life and, you know, without money in rural El Salvador from after living in Austin, you know, with our public school system and all of that. So it's tough on people, and it's often dangerous for them to go back, because even if they're not facing asylum or political persecution, oftentimes people who go back to poor communities in other countries, they have the stigma of wealth. They've been living in the U.S. and they're coming back and they're very rich, and they get extorted or attacked by gangs just because they were in the U.S. and everybody knows about it. It's not good. And I mean, you know, we don't even really in this administration talk about asylum anymore. And I think it's relevant for this group that the reason as a nation we offer asylum is because of our failure to do so during World War II. And we became a nation that identified as one that protects people who are fleeing persecution. And we built out this very robust body of law and case law and identity as a nation about people. You come to our border and you tell us you need protection, and we will offer you that. And we turn everybody away now. We're in such a deep, dark hole that we're just trying not to get families who are living and existing in the United States to be separated. But I have a goal, a hope, that we stop doing that and we shut down these horrific detention centers and get back to the point where we were, which is a nation of hope and a beacon of light where people who are fleeing something can actually come here and get protection, because that really is who we are.
We're taking a quick break, and we'll be right back with more of the panel, Paths, Barriers, and Possibilities, Immigration in America. Stay with us. You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. This is a live panel discussion recorded last month, Paths, Barriers, and Possibilities, Immigration in America. We're doing all this, according to the Republican leadership, is to make America safe. We heard from Greg Abbott that terrorists and rapists, all sorts of terrible people who are coming into the United States, and this is something that they have to do for national security. Also, during the Donald Trump's presidential campaign, he was saying getting rid of immigrants would lower the price of housing. Donald Trump still does very well in national polling on securing the border, yet the polling is really bad about the performance of ICE. So how do we square that in terms of like how do we have a conversation?
So I think what's happened is that, and it did feel this way for, and it still does, but not as much. It started to feel like political parties were religions. And I mean that by saying that someone at the head would say something and the public, or at least their public, would consume it and believe it. And that was it. There was no questioning. What I think has happened is that the rhetoric has started to not materialize in terms of the way people thought their lives would look or the way it would look on the ground. And now there's more skepticism. And I think that we have to capitalize on that skepticism, because even people who maybe bought into it before aren't with them anymore. I actually think that the public that agrees wholesale with everything that the administration, both the Texas and DC Republican administration, are doing, that they agree wholesale, I think it's actually a very small group of people. I'm not saying that they're all Democrats now, they're all going to vote for all Democrats, but they might vote for a Democrat. They might vote for some sort of change. So I really think that exposure matters a lot. This is where what's happening to the national media and it consolidating gets very scary, because the controlling information, I think, is the next big frontier. The public is getting very, very savvy as to what is and isn't real. What's happening is that they're having to self-report, they're having to do it for themselves, because less and less, because media is consolidating, there are fewer and fewer trusted sources, fewer and fewer trusted voices, right? But I think that we're on the cusp of them not being able to hold on to it anymore. To the point in the question you asked, Joaquin, my biggest fear is that Democrats have spent so much time telling you how bad Republicans are, that as a group, all of us are not ready to lead if we're given the opportunity. I think that Democrats have to be ready to lead the minute that we get to sit in the driver's seat. We can't catch our breath and take a few beats to get our bearings. I think we have to have people who are ready to go right away. That's where I think we are. I think that the dam is cracking, but we have to be ready.
So you want a Democratic Project 2027 or something?
I don't want anything. I don't believe in just doing the mirror image or photo negative, a reference very few of us get now, but of what they do. I do believe, and I'm not saying just Republican, Democrat, I do believe that we should put power and authority into the hands of better people, not people willing to play the same game just on a different team. I do believe in a moral authority and a greater good. So I wouldn't handle Project 2025 the way that they did. I would be very transparent and open about what we want to do and how we're going to execute it, not tell them one thing and then do something else.
They're pretty transparent in what they wanted to do. Even now, they're still at CPAC up in Dallas-Fort Worth. They want to deport 100 million people. That includes American citizens.
Right, but what I'm saying, though, is that he distanced himself from that early on, and now they're still playing stupid. We know what they're doing. I just think that we should have a straight line. Just say, this is what we're going to do. This is how we're going to do it. Here's who's going to be in charge. This is what you can expect. Your life should look like this in 10 weeks or 2 months, and then do that.
Congressman Castro, birthright citizenship, waiting for the Supreme Court to come down with the decision. What are you expecting? How big could this be?
I believe and I hope that they will uphold birthright citizenship. It would be devastating, I think, for the country if they overturn it. I'm also watching the Voting Rights Act and what they do with that. If they overturn the Voting Rights Act, then I think that, assuming there's still a Republican majority at the time here in Texas, I think that the legislature will probably seek to redraw congressional districts as soon as they can. And those districts may look completely like spaghetti strings or something, because there are only so many protections after that that would keep them from creating districts that, the districts, as you all know, look very oddly shaped now, but creating things that we've never seen before. And so those are the two big cases that I'm watching in terms of voting rights and rights of citizenship.
All right, I have some questions from our audience. Can one of our panelists outline the pathway to shutting down Dilley and all detention centers? How can we help? How can the public help?
Well, the public, I believe, is the reason that when I first went to Dilley in January, late January, there were 1,100 people there. The next time I went, there were 450 people there. Last Monday, it was down to 102. So thank all of you. Thank everybody who has spoken up. Everybody who has posted on Facebook or Instagram or anything, certainly the folks that have contributed legal defense funds, everything, we need to shut Dilley down and never reopen that place.
A question from the audience. What is your stance on Dreamers, specifically those in college? Right, what is happening with Dreamers? Katie, are they being targeted as well for deportation?
Yes, they are here and there. Right now, they're in legal limbo. They've been in legal limbo for a really long time. The Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals issued a decision finding that the program is now legal. However, Ken Paxton created an argument that Texas would suffer hardship by having to issue driver's licenses to Dreamers in Texas. So the Fifth Circuit found that of all 50 states, Texas on its own won't have to issue work permits to Dreamers. But that case, that decision by the Fifth Circuit has to be implemented by the federal judge. Andrew Hanen is his name, and he received motions from both sides in late November, and we're still awaiting a final decision from him implementing what we think the outcome will be, which is the program is legal, DACA initial applications, meaning people who have never received DACA but qualify, can obtain DACA, but that Dreamers in Texas might face losing their work permits. And I don't know the inner workings of Hanen's, you know, quarters or what's going on behind the scenes. My suspicion is that he understands the gravity of his decision and is being very methodical and thoughtful about it. Or maybe my hope. I don't know if any of the panelists have insights. I would love to hear them because I get asked by people literally every single day, what about DACA? Because there are hundreds of thousands of Dreamers in Texas, and these are people, of course, who were raised here, they have jobs, and these are people who are in their 20s or 30s, and you know, in that time of your life, you make a lot of decisions about, you know, going to college or graduate school or getting married or buying a house or having children. And when you live your life in limbo in the way that they have, it puts those crucial early life decisions on hold. And I think that is the main pain of the Dreamers, is that they're just living in limbo. And ultimately, they deserve and should have a pathway to permanent status. And we need, absolutely, we need Congress to pass that.
How impossible it must feel to be an immigration attorney in Texas right now. And she's probably working harder and trying harder than she ever has in her whole career, because that's who we are, right? So there's that. But the other thing, again, I think the public is more informed by itself than it ever has been. And what's also happening is this. I can scare you with some boogeyman that may not ever touch your actual life. But what's happening in Texas now, some piece of it, whether it's immigration or the economy, or education, or the job market, it is making its way into people's homes. Now there are things happening in everyone's life. Something is happening in their life that is not being spoken to. And I think that is the pushback. That is the difference. And I think that's sort of what we've all been pushing for all this time. And I really think we're in a moment where things will change because of it.
All right, we got to close out here. So, Kate, if you could just... Where are we in your practice? What's happening with immigration? Is there light at the end of the tunnel? Is there really hope, or is that a train coming at us?
I'm very hopeful. I'm very hopeful about the midterms and people paying attention. And I think that there are a lot of folks. I mean, we're in an era, of course, it's AI and social media, and people get in these echo chambers, and a lot of folks who are decent humans and well-meaning have intentionally withdrawn or even checked out from their feeds, from the news cycle, but they would be as outraged as all of us are. And so I think that what's really important in the age of AI and social media, when the world is changing around us, is that we actually like reach out to the humans and have coffee or lunch, or pick the five people that you know who are decent people, and make sure that they see a news article that you think might resonate with them, something from a, you know, outlet that you trust, and text it to them. Don't tag them on social media. Like, actually get this information into the people who would care, except that they don't know. And I think, you know, how to resist is a whole other conversation. And are you out marching? Are you running for office? Are you serving as a politician? Are you on social media? Are you being loud? That requires a level of risk tolerance that a lot of people don't have. But the social network, the supporting, the donating, the talking to your friends, the giving a five-star review to some immigrant-owned business that you think has really good food, like all of that stuff we can do. And if we do something small every single day, we are doing our part and making an impact. And so don't let the overwhelm of the job that needs to be done by our contingent paralyze you. It's the little things that each of us do that are ultimately going to make the impact.
Right. This has been Paths, Barriers, and Possibilities, Immigration in America, a live panel discussion recently hosted at Trinity University's Ruth Taylor Recital Hall
organized by the National Council of Jewish Women San Antonio. On the panel were San Antonio Congressman Joaquin Castro, San Antonio State Representative Diego Bernal, and immigration attorney Kate Lincoln Goldfinch. The panel organizers had reached out and invited local Republican elected officials to join us, but none agreed to do so. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Thank you for listening.